Well, again, I just want to say how glad I am to be here and how glad I am that you are here. My message is something you already know. It's the simplest message of all, but it's the hardest one to believe in, that God is present right here and right now in our lives. Nothing is more important than remembering that, though, and nothing is harder in a way. It's so simple. And yet I think we forget that. We struggle to believe that these aren't just ideas, these aren't just abstractions, that there's a reality here. I mean, otherwise, what's the point? If it's just Christ then and Christ there, if it's just Christ in the Bible, I mean, in some way, I'm just amazed sometimes that the church survives the way it does, because so often it's just an abstraction, it's just an idea. And how do people keep coming to Mass every day and every Sunday for this idea? And yet we do. We do, but the struggle is to think it's more than an idea, that it's a reality. We all know that. I want to teach you the examine of conscience, which you already know. Even if you don't know it by that name or don't know it in the way that I want to try to teach it to you, we all know it. It's a way of praying our lives. It's a way of reflecting on our experience. It's prayer as autobiography. And it's simple. And yet, I think we need each other. I think we need to come together like this and join together. There's something about being together that helps us remember, helps us focus. My beautiful and talented assistants should have handed out to you a bookmark. And the whole conference is just on this bookmark. It's all there. And you should also have a handout. And on that handout is a poem by the great American poet Mary Oliver. And as I read this poem, it's a deceptively simple poem. We English teachers, not Andy, but the rest of us, we've ruined literature because we've made it into, you know, this sort of game of analysis or something. You know, say profound things about this work of literature, or, you know, come up with the right interpretation, and that's not, for me, what poetry is about or what these poems are about. I'm not interested in the correct interpretation, just whatever stands out to you for whatever reason, even if you're not a poetry person. You know, usually when I say I'm going to share poems, people, you know, head for the door. The poetry is just a way of organizing our attention, just like summer conferences, just like the Mass is. It's a deceptively simple poem, and as I read it aloud, I would like you to underline two or three phrases that stand out to you for whatever reason. You're not maybe even sure why. 5 a.m. in the Pine Woods. I'd seen their hoof prints in the deep needles and knew they ended the long night under the pines, walking like two mute and beautiful women toward the deeper woods. So I got up in the dark and went there. They came slowly down the hill and looked at me sitting under the blue trees. Shyly, they stepped closer and stared from under their thick lashes and even nibbled some damp tassels of weeds. This is not a poem about a dream, though it could be. This is a poem about the world that is ours, or could be. Finally, one of them, I swear it, would have come to my arms, but the other stamped sharp hoof in the pine needles like the tap of sanity, and they went off together through the trees. When I woke, I was alone. I was thinking, so this is how you swim inward. So this is how you flow outward. So this is how you pray. So a word or a phrase that stood out. Yeah, please.
just for some reason, or could be, like the hope that
okay.
could be.
Okay, or could be, which is repeated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or could be. What could be for us? Somebody else, a word or a phrase that, for whatever reason. Yeah, please.
I love to swim inward, flow outward.
Yeah, at the very end, swim inward, flow outward. Again, repetition there. Yeah, please.
Oh, I've seen those footprints too.
Mm-hmm.
They ate my hostas.
I know. Yeah, what's the big deal about the deer? Yeah, they just eat our roses. We had a cougar sighting at our place. So there was a cougar walking down our street. We didn't see it. And I thought, good, you know, bring it on. Let's get rid of some of those deer. Yeah, please, Ina. Yeah, under the blue trees, yeah. Because it's dark. And yeah, please.
I like this. And beautiful women toward the deeper woods.
Mm-hmm.
I love.
Yeah, you know too. Yeah, you do. Yeah. And that sense of the feminine that I want to highlight. Yeah, please.
So I got up in the dark.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it's interesting what she does. I mean, in a sense, this is not an experience she controls at all, right? She gets up and she sees these deer and something happens. And part of what happens is that she can't control what happens. But she does get up. And it's in the dark. It's in the dark. Yeah, please, Ricardo.
I like the, they came slowly down the hill.
Mm-hmm.
That is the time
mm-hmm.
for yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And yet there's the tap of sanity and... And they're gone. Yeah, please.
This is a poem about the world that is ours, or could be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Mystery.
Yeah, please, Julie.
Well, I don't want to get rid of my deer. they make great eye contact. So
they do.
They looked at me.
Yeah, they looked at me. Yeah. That sense of connection. You know, what's interesting about this poem is that until she uses the word pray, this is not a specifically religious poem at all. Speaking of people scattering, you know, at OSU, if I say the word God, I just get the G out, and people are gone. And you say Jesus, you know, and then they come back and, I don't know, want to do something to you. We are, I think rightly, in some ways, I mean, I love religious language. I love the language of the church. I love the language of the church. The language of the Mass. There's a certain rhythm to it and a sound to it. And yet there's a way in which that language, for a lot of people, is off-putting. It's off-putting. Mary Oliver's maybe the most popular poet in America right now. I heard her read at Arlene Schnitzer. How many people does Arlene Schnitzer hold? Were you there at
yes.
that?
That was amazing.
Was it
thousands?
And she would call out the title of a poem and people would start to applaud. I hate it when that happens at my readings. So. And she was just great. She was just great. And I think people are longing for the spiritual, but they don't trust the churches, or they don't, as Father Charlie was saying, they don't know how to hear it or see that language here. So this is how you pray. That's the shock. That's the surprise. I'd like you to take out a sheet of paper. If you have a journal, a notebook, that's great. If you don't, have pens, borrow one from your neighbor. This is writing that nobody else will see. The point of this is not the writing. It's just a tool. There are lots and lots of ways to pray, depending on your personality and your way of thinking and being in the world. And I tend to get distracted very easily when I pray. So I find centering prayer really difficult. But writing helps me to focus. So journaling, I'm just suggesting journaling. And what I want you to do, some of you know, Andy knows, lots of you know about free writing, which is not really free writing, it's forced writing. I'm going to time you. I'm going to give you I'll give you a topic. The topic is, I wish I had a board. need to write on a board at some point. Oh, it's right there. Blank AM or PM in the blank. Blank AM, like 10 PM in the coffee shop, or 2:30 on the freeway, or just a time and a place to imagine yourself there. And when I have you start, if you start writing about something else, shift to write about a number of scenes and moments, that's fine. If you don't write about the topic at all, that's fine. This is just a jumping off point. Nobody will see this. Write badly. Don't worry about grammar and punctuation. Don't worry about sounding stupid. Write slowly. It's physical. It's like yoga in that sense. If you don't know what to say, write, "I don't know what to say." You can do that for 7 minutes. It's all right. Nobody will know. The only thing I will see is whether your pen is moving. And just put yourself there. Don't worry about the words. But think about a moment like this. A brief moment, a fleeting moment. It might not even necessarily be a moment of prayer. Or you might not have thought of it as a prayerful moment. You might have forgotten about it. So I'm going to give you 7 minutes. Just repeat the last word of the sentence if you can't figure out what to say. Don't worry. Write badly. Starting now. Okay, stop. So how was that? Was that, some of you are very comfortable with this, but awkward? Easy? Did you write about lots of different things? Yeah.
I just haven't done it in so long, it just felt like going home.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. Somebody else, hard? Easy? Natural? Unnatural? Yeah, Susie? Yeah. Yeah. You think it's different writing by hand too than typing? You can certainly type in a laptop if you have a laptop, that's fine. Yeah, please.
The difference between writing with a pen and typing. I just have more, for some reason, more connection with a pen. Like it's,
yeah.
Because it's like right in my hand.
It's physical.
More, you know,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, in a way, writing in that sense for spiritual purposes is like the rosary, right? It's physical. There's something you can hold on to. These are the first few paragraphs in the preface to this new book. The shock of stars at 5 a.m., the bright belt of Orion, and the arc and sweep of those other brilliant, nameless lights, and even the blackness glittering, the smell of wood smoke and fur, the cold, damp air. I hear the voice of my wife calling from another room. "Do you know where I put my book?" Standing at the sink, rinsing out a bowl, I look up and see a strand of a spider web rising and falling, made visible by the wind, then another and another, looping from the willow to the roof, glinting on and off, as if all the shingles and boards of the house are secretly bound with thread. We all have moments like this, moments that move us somehow, that seem to mean something we can't quite put into words, but we are embarrassed by them, or we doubt them, or in the rush of things that happen to us each day, we forget about them. For a moment, we believed in something, a presence, a beauty, but we let the moment pass. I was cresting the hill, Highland Hill, on the outskirts of Corvallis. And I looked up as you go into Crescent Valley. We live on the edge of McDonald Forest, about 8 miles north of town. And so I got city limits and got to the hill. I looked up and there was an eagle, a bald eagle, that was skimming the rooftops. And of course, that's becoming more common now too, but still, it's a spectacular thing. I thought, wow, a bald eagle. And by the time I got home, another 3 or 4 miles, I had forgotten about it. I pulled into the driveway and it was out of my head. I was thinking about the things I had been thinking about, what I had to do that night. I didn't remember it until the next morning, until I was journaling. And wait a minute, I saw a bald eagle and it just went out of my mind. We all have these moments. A student asked me how come there aren't any burning bushes anymore? And I said, who says there aren't? For Mary Oliver, there's a very interesting quote from a book of her prose that I have in this handout. And again, she's describing this moment. She's a Christian poet. I think Episcopalian. But here she's writing about an experience very similar to what she writes about in the poem. And she's saying that it's one of the most important experiences of her life, but she doesn't use specifically religious language. Once years ago, I emerged from the woods in the early morning at the end of a walk, and it was the most casual of moments. That's what I would emphasize. Not necessarily that it takes place in nature, although nature is where a lot of us feel very close to God. As I stepped from under the trees into the mild pouring down sunlight, I experienced a sudden impact, a seizure of happiness. It was not the drowning sort of happiness, rather the floating sort. The theme of our conference is joy, but I think she's using happiness here in part the way I would use joy, or our tradition uses the word joy. Joy not as overpowering. I mean, there's overpowering joy, joy that flattens us. But there's quiet joy, subtle joy, fleeting joy. I made no struggle toward it. It was given. Time seemed to vanish. Urgency vanished. Any important difference between myself and all other things vanished. I knew that I belonged to the world, and I felt comfortably my own containment in the reality. I did not feel that I understood the mystery, not at all. And that's important too. I think one sign of the authenticity of these experiences is exactly that we don't understand. We feel something we can't quite explain. Rather, I could be happy and feel blessed within the perplexity. Blessed within the perplexity. The summer morning, its gentleness, the sense of the great work being done, though the grass where I stood scarcely trembled. As I say, it was the most casual of moments, not mystical, as the word is usually meant, for there was no vision or anything extraordinary at all, but only a sudden awareness of the citizenry of all things within one world, leaves, dust, thrushes and finches, men and women. Again, Mary Oliver's a nature poet, you could say, although that kind of diminishes her. And I want to celebrate that way of experiencing what I'm trying to describe, but that's not the only thing. I mean, this could happen in a city. It can happen reading a book. It happens at dinner. It happens washing the dishes, as I suggested. And yet it was a moment I have never forgotten and upon which I have based many decisions in the years since. Now, as Christians, what we do as Christians is we name that experience, the experience that lots of people have and might interpret later. Notice she describes the moment with the deer and then she interprets it. So this is, I think that's what we do. We have these experiences. And then if we're not Christian, if we're agnostic, or we're heavily influenced by science and engineering, all praise for science and engineering. Most of my students are science and engineering students. I taught a Bible as literature class with 17 students, 16 electrical engineering majors. It's an honors class, and one political science major. No English majors. But if we're used to seeing things in those scientific or technical terms, we might identify that moment and say, well, that was biochemistry, or that was serotonin, or that was I had a good meal, or maybe it comes from class and privilege, and we could look at it from that point of view, as my one political science kept doing, my political scientist kept doing in that class. Or, if we're Jewish or Muslim, we might name it in certain ways, but as Christians, we name that experience Christ, and that's the central insight of St. Paul, that the life of this human being who lived and died and then rose again has something to do with us. The pattern of his life is the pattern of our life. And that whatever we experience that is good, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, is Christ. This is what Paul means in Galatians, in chapter 5 of Galatians. And I have a little quote here. These are the fruits of the Spirit we used to memorize, right? We don't experience Christ directly, most of us. We don't hear His voice. Some people do. I still believe that that's possible. We don't see angels directly, although some people do. I'm not invested in saying that doesn't happen. I'm invested in saying, wait a minute, for those, you know, the rest of us, it's happening in another way. And if we don't see that, we're going to lose our faith. We're going to think this is all made up. It's just some strange, ancient, you know, set of ideas and practices. But what Paul is saying is whenever we feel certain things, those feelings, what's moving in us, those are signs of the presence of God, the presence of the Spirit. And notice, part of what I am doing a little bit right now, although I'm kind of moving back and forth, is I'm switching to the Spirit. Sometimes I find that the people I work with are almost put off by the images of Jesus. It's odd. I mean, it's so wonderful that we have our Lord in the flesh. But I am so influenced by the actors who've played Jesus, and the art I've seen of Jesus, and the historical Jesus, that sometimes Jesus in my prayer life, the physical Jesus, can become almost too literal. And so I switch to the Spirit, and that's not cheating. We're Trinitarian. The Spirit is God. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are together, are one, different expressions of the same reality in relationship to each other. And so I think sometimes for us as 21st century people, the Spirit is a way of kind of revitalizing our sense of prayer. And Paul is saying the Spirit is manifested in love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. These are all things that people who don't believe experience. These are all things that everybody experiences. But what Paul is saying is those feelings are a sign of the work of the Spirit. We reason from the fruit to the roots. And on the contrary, there are the signs of the flesh, the work of the flesh. Fornication, not to get too personal, impurity, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, technology, enmity, strife, jealousy, anger, quarrels, dissensions, factions, envy, drunkenness, carousing, and things like that. When you finish writing the email, don't send it. If it comes out of anger, don't send it. If you're getting ready to launch some kind of coup within your department, don't do it. You do kind of a checklist. Say, wait a minute, that's not God. The voice of radical self-doubt and self-loathing, that is never the voice of God, never. God speaks to us in our joy. Paul says, I have been crucified with Christ, and it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. Where do we find God? We find God in ourselves. In the things that happen to us, in our feelings and our thoughts, we have to discern. Not everything that moves in us is God. But God is moving there too. And the trick is to be able to identify, wait a minute, that is the Lord. It's the Lord. If you turn the page, that's where the examine comes in. The examine is a very simple way. It goes back to St. Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits from the 16th century. And he didn't invent it. He popularized it. He thought, if there was one way to pray, the most important way, this is it, if you could pray in no other way. A lot of you are from Jesuit schools, so you know this already. This is my simplification of the examine of conscience. Examine is a Spanish word that just means examination. We often use it before confession to focus on our sins. But what the tradition has been doing since Ignatius, and really Ignatius too, is opening that up. So it's very, very simple. I'm focusing on the first one today. It's three steps. You remember the light and give thanks for the light. And that's this moment of the deer. That's the moment of the stars and the voice and the web. And you give thanks. Thank you, Lord. You remember those moments of light. Next conference, I'm going to be concentrating on the darkness, facing the darkness, because we have to look at the darkness too, the darkness in us. and outside of us. We have to face the darkness. When we've cooperated with it, when we've acted on it, or when we've experienced it in others. And we ask for refuge. We ask for forgiveness. We ask for strength. And then the third step is to just to let it all go. To say yes. To say this is true and that is true. We try to discern what God is calling us to do, but with the sense that this is mystery finally, and that we have to surrender to God. We have to live with things the way they are. It's really very simple. And it focuses on the simple. And Ignatius says, the small, not that we can't have overpowering experiences, getting knocked down the way Paul was in Acts on the way to Damascus. Although that's the account of Paul's conversion in Acts from whoever wrote Luke. It's not Paul's own account in Galatians. You might think of that as a narrative version, a dramatic version, being knocked down of what happens more subtly. Well, it's exactly what Father Charlie was preaching this morning. In those who are making spiritual progress, the action of the good angel is gentle, light, and sweet as a drop of water entering a sponge. Slow, steady. It's a little bit like climate change, but in a positive sense. We don't see it right away. Things just are slowly heating up. And that's the way it is in a joyous sense. This is Jean-Pierre de Caussade. Very powerful. The book is called Abandonment to Divine Providence. My dear souls, you are seeking for secret ways of belonging, but there is only one, making use of whatever he offers you. Everything leads you to union with him. The blood flowing through your veins only flows by his will. Every feeling and every thought you have, no matter how they arise, all come from God's invisible hand. You have nothing to do but love and cherish what each moment brings. That's all I'm saying. Andy, I'm going to need you to run the video here in a second. Or this is Augustine, who wrote the first autobiography in Western culture, The Confessions. And he had to do that as a Christian. That's the Christian mode. If it's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me, the way I write about Christ is to write about my own experience, the things that happen to me. So it's really good news. God is everywhere. God is in all parts of our life. It's also a challenge. And I want to show you the end of Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ. I want to show you the resurrection scene. And I want you to notice this scene. And I want you to notice where the camera is. And where we are then as we're looking at this. And what happens here. It's even subtler than I thought it was going to be.
It was working.
I'm supposed to give Andy a hard time about technology, Jay? Yeah. We had it. Well, I now will do a dramatic interpretation of this. I will now perform this. Just a minute. You see how kind of calm he was? Actually, he looked a little bit like Mel Gibson just then. This is a movie that was enormously, as you know, influential when it first came out, and it still is. More people came to the discussion I had in my Bible as Literature class, or my Bible as Literature, my Bible study, on the Passion of the Christ than ever came. They're talking about the gospel itself. And I've had people, oh, thanks be to God. See, I doubted him. See, don't doubt. Believe. So take a look at where we are in this. Thank you, Andy. It's a beautiful scene. This is not a movie that I like, I should tell you. You should. It's fine. Lots of people I know love this movie. And Mel Gibson is a brilliant movie maker. So where is the camera? It's hard to tell, isn't it? It does look a little like space. And light and dark, I mean, Gibson is very smart. What's this? What's happening? Yeah, that's the resurrection. Who's this? I mean, it sounds like a dumb question. Who is this? Well, yeah, it's Jim, whatever his name is. Jim. But who is he in the movie? It's Jesus. How do we know it's Jesus?
He has a long hair.
Has a beard. We're going to find out another way here. That's the other way we know. But it's the same actor who's been playing Jesus all along. And we have this nice military strong music. You can turn it off now. You can turn it. You can stop. Yeah. Now, what I want to say about the kind of joy that I'm talking about and the kind of joy that we're promised in the gospel is that it is nothing like that. It is nothing like that. I have the gospel account right here. Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. Where's the camera? Outside the tomb. Where's the camera here? Inside the tomb. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting, it should be, sorry, waiting, that's the Greek, where the body of Jesus had been lying, one at the head and the other at the feet. Which of the four Gospels describes the resurrection? None of them. The resurrection is not described in any of the four canonical Gospels. We have post-resurrection accounts. What we have is the empty tomb. What we're told is that he is not here. Now, Gibson is certainly entitled. Could you get me to my PowerPoints?
Yep.
Because I believe in you completely. They said to her, "Why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." When she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there. But she did not know that it was Jesus. She didn't know it was him. Jesus said, supposing him to be the gardener, Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for?" Supposing him to be the gardener, not the action here. I think part of the reason some people like the Passion of the Christ so much is that it's Jesus as Braveheart. It's Jesus as the patriot. It's Jesus as an action hero, not the gardener. I mean, I love gardeners. I don't mean to put gardeners down. But I think in this context, just the gardener. And not obviously Jesus. She said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said to her, "Do not hold on to me, because I have not yet ascended to the Father." We can't hold on to him. We can't hold on to him. But go to my brothers and say, "I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." This is the very nature of the post-resurrection experiences, that Jesus is not recognized even by his closest friends. And then as soon as he is, he vanishes. The emphasis then is on storytelling, on people coming and saying what they experienced, trying to, you know, that we'll talk more about the Emmaus story later, you know, that we're not our hearts burning. Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord," and she told them that he had said these things to her. So my sense of Gibson, and can I get the very first slide? Can you go to my very first slide? Is I think it's very, very important. This is Mel Gibson. for us to recognize, I mean, Gibson is entitled to interpret things however he wants, and he is interpreting things. But, and this is in a New Yorker profile, but he's saying he's not changing things. Gibson has said that his script for The Passion was the New Testament, and that the film was directed by the Holy Ghost. Ask Gibson who wrote the Gospel of John, and he would not hesitate to answer that it was John. That's why it's called the Gospel according to John. Ditto Matthew, Mark, and Luke. These are reliable sources. These are guys who were around. Scholarly interpretations always dick around with it, you know? Gibson says, it's revisionist bullshit. And that's what these academics are into. Just get an academic on board if you want to pervert something. Well, I resent that, and I said, Mr. Gibson, I respectfully suggest that you read the Gospel. And you've simplified it. You've simplified it. You've made it obvious when it isn't obvious. And I'm not trying to say you need to have a PhD in order to understand the Gospels. No, there's something huge at stake, that God is all around us, but not if we think he looks like that. He looks like the gardener. In fact, here's Pope Francis. We saw a billboard driving up here. Jesus has risen from the dead beyond reasonable doubt. That's on the way up I-5. And this is exactly the opposite of our tradition. I'm not trying to get things fuzzy. I'm trying to say, wait a minute, we're in this too. It is the good news. It's kind of the hard news, because we want the permanent and we get the fleeting. We want the objective, we get the subjective. We want the obvious, we get the subtle. I mean, again, Father Charlie was talking about this, and it's in the Gospel this morning, is that people have eyes, but they don't want to see. They turn away. We don't want, in a way, the joy we get. It's not good enough for us. We want the movie version, not the Gospels. The Gospels are too boring. Just words on a page. In fact, just really small words, simple words, a little bit like the words of Mary Oliver's poem. Nothing fancy. Just lots of meaning between the lines. But what our tradition is saying, what the Gospel is saying, is celebrate the uncertainty, because uncertainty is the sign of the authenticity of the call. In this quest to find God in all things, and this is Pope Francis really sounding like a Jesuit. Father Charlie Gordon is a systematic theologian. I was at a deacon conference. That's what the NDICE is. Sounds like one of those evil, you know, organizations in a, you know, James Bond movie, the NDICE, the National Diaconal Institute for Continuing Education. And there are a couple of systematic theologians who are talking there, trying to talk about Amoris Laetitia, the joy of family, and they were just so upset because Pope Francis is not systematic. That's because he's a spiritual director. In this quest to find God in all things, there is still an area of uncertainty. There must be. If a person says that he met God with total certainty and is not touched by some margin of uncertainty, then this is not good. If one has the answers to all the questions, that is proof that God is not with him. We're in. It's okay. We're uncertain. We belong. If you're lost, you're on the right track. It means that he is a false prophet using religion for himself. You must leave room for God. Not for certainties. We must be humble. Uncertainty is in every true discernment. And I want to skip here. There are a couple of very interesting quotes here about the resurrection in particular from the Catechism, which says the resurrection was something that happened in history, but it transcended history. Speaking of the resurrection here, It was an event that was beyond the historical, that could not just be perceived with the senses. Pope Benedict called the resurrection in Jesus of Nazareth, his book Jesus of Nazareth, an evolutionary breakthrough, which is really interesting, because in a way what I'm invoking very much throughout all that I do in this book and in the conference is Teilhard de Chardin, who emphasized the idea of diaphany. Not epiphany, diaphany. That all of creation, water is always becoming wine. The rain falls and the grapes grow and we crush them and enzymes do whatever enzymes do and we have wine. Epiphany, an individual you know, kind of vertical intercession, but all of creation evolving towards Christ. And Pope Benedict invoking Teilhard de Chardin, who died in 1955, the year I was born, and was not allowed to publish in his life. It was only later accepted. It's the cosmic Christ, Christ in nature. And Benedict says the resurrection is an evolutionary breakthrough, but here's Pope Francis. He's talking about, what does it mean? What does resurrection mean? And I think this is an interpretation of the gospel. Entering into the tomb, that is why we are here, to enter into the mystery which God has accomplished. We cannot live Easter without entering into the mystery. It is not something intellectual, something we only know or read about. It is more, much more. To enter into the mystery means the ability to wonder, to contemplate, the ability to listen to the silence, and to hear the tiny whisper amid great silence by which God speaks to us. So I'm not making this up. I mean, you look at the tradition, you look at Gospels, you look at the teaching coming from the church now. It's the whisper. To enter into the mystery demands that we are not afraid of reality, of suffering and darkness. 1,000 children died yesterday of malaria in the world. 1,000 children died of malaria in the world yesterday. That we are not locked into ourselves, that we not flee from what we fail to understand, that we not close our eyes to problems or deny them, that we not dismiss our questions. And what does free writing have to do with this? There's a nice little quote here from Peter Elbow, the father of free writing, who says what you have to do when you free write is simply force yourself to write and don't worry about sounding stupid. You let go. That tap of sanity that they go off, postpone that. Speed is not the goal. The only point is to keep writing, to keep going. In a sense, to get deeper than your conscious mind. Andy, just in the last 2 minutes, could you give me the second two images, the next one after this? One after this, yeah. What we want is this. Whoops, next one. Go up. Wait, you're going to spoil my punchline. Back. Go up. Back. Sorry, go up all the way up to the top. There. We want this. This is Caravaggio's inspiration of Matthew. Notice he's writing. He's free writing, I think. And there's the angel saying, write this down. And I just don't think that's how it works. I think we're writing, we'd have no idea. And then go to the next one. That's what it's like. We want the angel, and we get this. We get the clouds. In Qigong, they call it cloud hands. Do you know about Qigong? It's like Tai Chi, before Tai Chi. You have your hands out like this. They're cloud hands. I love that. Cloud hands. You're writing with cloud hands. I was going to have you free write for another 5 minutes, but you're going like this, you can't talk anymore. So let's, what I want you to do with your free writing is I want you to hold on to it, and I want you to bring it to the conference tomorrow, and we'll have more time and I'll have you do some more writing. I do want you to do a little bit of reading tonight though. I want you to read what you wrote, and I want you to underline 3 or 4 things that stand out for whatever reason. They don't have to be related to the topic. They might not make any sense. You might not have even been aware you wrote it, but just something that sounds interesting, that speaks to you exactly the way you did with the poem, and bring it to the conference tomorrow.
Dear Lord, my dream.